Investing Simplified is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisory firm. Price Financial Group has been doing estate planning since 1970 and investment and retirement planning since 1975. Individual situations may vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Investing Simplified is the longest-running live financial program with a certified financial planner, estate planning attorney, and a certified public accountant to answer your questions for free. Got a tough estate, tax, or financial problem keeping you up at night? You can call the show right now at 503-222-9700. That's 503-222-9700. Long distance and podcast listeners can call toll free at 800-344-5836. Coming to you live from Portland, Oregon, and broadcast on affiliated stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Bo Caldwell.
Investing Simplified.
And welcome into Investing Simplified. However you're listening, thanks for making us a part of your day. I'm Bo Caldwell, CEO of Price Financial Group Wealth Management, Press Financial Group, and I don't even know how to speak, Matt. But, you know, Matt May is in with me today, CIO, Chief Investment Officer. Hello, Matt.
How you doing, Bo?
You know, it's another day in smoky Portland. I guess that's our new normal here with wildfires and such, right?
I just wanted to let everyone out there know, just really thinking about you all. We're all part of this community, and we're all experiencing some really extraordinary times with the wildfires and COVID. So our hearts go out to all of you, and hopefully you're faring well in the tough times.
That's a really good point. I appreciate you sharing that, although bringing a little downer to the show here as people start. But it's good to point out there that we do, you know, we are sending our prayers and our thoughts out to those folks that are affected by the wildfires. If you are interested in donating, I know there are a lot of GoFundMes. There are a lot of online, you know, places to donate money to help those people that are affected by the wildfires. Because, you know, as a state, not just as a community here in the Portland metro area, and I should say not just as a state, because a lot of folks listen in Washington too, but
California as well.
Yeah, all along the West Coast, we've had this spate of wildfires. So wherever you are listening from, we hope that you're safe. We hope that that you are well taken care of. But thank you for tuning in. And on a better note, you know, we have some news this week, Matt. I mean, some stuff has happened this week, some big time stuff happening in the stock market. You know, what's really jumping out at you?
Yeah, so some big things this week. There was a pretty significant IPO. That's an initial public offering by a company called Snowflake. And they're a tech company. They provide cloud-based data platform services in the U.S. and also internationally. It was the largest software company IPO ever, and they raised about $3.4 billion. And another interesting note, this is a large holding for Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway.
Interesting.
So they bought about 28 million shares, or excuse me, $570 million worth of that.
$570 million investment in one company that just did, and you mentioned IPO, because I know a lot of people will have questions about that. An IPO is an initial public offering, and what that means, folks, if you don't know, is that the company was previously privately held. So when you see companies, Price Financial Group is one of those. We are a privately held company. We're not publicly traded. There's a lot of companies that may be ubiquitous to your life that, you know, make products that you use or that you buy from, and they're not publicly traded. Target, Walmart, you know, the big box stores, those are publicly traded companies. But a lot of times the way that companies raise money in order to invest in, whether that's research and development in new locations in staff, is they do an initial public offering, right?
That's correct. So in this offering, they were looking to sell about 28 million shares.
Okay.
So that's their first offering to investors to get in. And Warren Buffett's company was one of the largest shareholders that wanted to buy shares. Also, Salesforce was another significant shareholder that submitted for the offering. And they expected it to open at about $110 to around $120 per share. It actually opened above $240 per share.
That's even for my simple mind math, that seems like that's double what they were expecting.
And initially, like several weeks ago, they were thinking that it was going to be in like the high 70s to mid 80s. And they kept adjusting the target a little bit higher to get to that $110 to $120 per share range. And then it just more than doubled right from there. And wow. Actually, first day of trading, it exceeded over $300 a share. I think I want to say something like $319 it peaked out at.
Wow. Wow. You know, that's just crazy. You know, and I do you have any advice for people that are thinking about, you know, investing in IPOs? And again, it's always comes with the caveat that we don't know your individual situation, folks. So if anything, when we talk about individual companies, about investments, types like that, I always have to throw that out there, the CYA, you know, sort of buffer. But make sure that you talk to an investment professional, talk to your tax professional about your specific situation. But because I have gotten folks that asked, they want to participate in an IPO. Is that a good idea? How can they participate in the IPO? Why don't we start with, what are your general thoughts on IPOs in general?
On IPOs, they are a bit of an untamed wild beast. I liken it to a fire hose. You turn it on full blast and then just let it go.
Or one of those tube men outside of the
tube men. Tube men. It just whipsaw. It can whipsaw up, down, left, right, all over the place. They're just unpredictable, and you never know which way an IPO is going to go. You could think that, like Facebook, that at I think it introed at like $34 to $40.
I thought it was $40, but somewhere around there.
Yeah. And it, you know, it went below $20.
Yeah, $17.60 I think is where it dropped to.
Somewhere around there, of course. That would have the $17 range, the $34, $38, $40s. All of those are much, much lower than where it's at now, years later. But that initial first few months, woo.
Can be. So it can be a good idea. What I'm hearing from you is that it can be a good idea to invest in an IPO conceivably. If it's a good company, if you've done your research and think that the company has legs, but for the first weeks, months, maybe even years, it could be like trying to grab one of those wacky inflatable tube men and holding on, or a full blown fire hose, like you said.
Absolutely. It could, you know, a 50% upwards or downwards move in a several week time frame is not unheard of.
Right. Or in the case of Snowflake, say 100% move in less than a day.
Plus, yeah.
Like this week it did that, you know, in just less than a day.
It looks so easy.
Yeah, right. And what a lot of people have asked, you know, Matt, and I've got this question, you know, over the years where people want to participate in an IPO is how can they get involved in that? And what they may not know is you can't just go to your standard broker. You know, if you have an Edward Jones guy, you're working with PFG, you're working with another investment advisor, they are not necessarily set up to be able to let you get in on the IPO. They have to actually be a member of a big firm, a Morgan Stanley, a Wells Fargo, one of those big players that participates in it, right?
Correct. And that is on the initial and in the primary market. That's right. Before it turns public, which is the secondary market. So on that primary market, those are the institutions that have shares available for purchase. And that's kind of the you got in early, so to speak.
Right. Well, and that's getting in on the shares that are offered, right? So you mentioned
Correct. That they're looking to sell on the offering, yep.
X amount of shares total on the offer. And that's, you have to be someone who a client of, or Warren Buffett, you know, you have to be Berkshire Hathaway. That's a big client of some institutional.
He has a little clout,
just a little bit of money.
He's been getting a lot of love from us lately.
Right. But those folks are, well, he is the Oracle, but those folks are the ones who can buy it at that $120 a share initial offering price. But then we, as general investors, individual investors, have to buy it when it hits what you call the secondary market. And that's where it's available on your E-Trades or your Robinhoods.
And that's when the frenzy starts, when everybody's just trying to get in. This is the first opportunity for the average investor to be able to take part in that opportunity. So there are some other hidden details. Usually, there's a lockup period for insiders that own, or employees, or maybe people that are in the know or have shares before it went public. Generally, that lockup period is like about 6 months. So that's another thing to look out for when you own IPO shares, is at that 6 month point, usually those locked up shares become tradable. So the people that hold those shares, they've probably made a good amount of money. In this case, with Snowflake, definitely so in day one. 6 months later, if they're up 200-300% or more, they might want to get out. And that would be potentially damaging to the share price if they're trying to sell a bunch of shares all at once.
Right, if they're trying to get out of it, and you know, because a lot of times people may or may not know. I mean, the reason that we hear about Elon Musk's, you know, his net worth going up or down by so much, or you know, or Mark Zuckerberg's, is because they own a lot of their money's tied up in shares of their own company, and mm-hmm. they have to disclose when they sell those. But in an initial public offering situation, so if hypothetically, you know, we own Price Financial Group, if we were to go public, then as the primary shareholders, you know, before we went public, we'd have to hold on to those shares, and then we could sell them 6 months later. We are not, full disclosure, we are not going public. We are not Snowflake. That is not something we're doing, but...
Correct.
But, you know, just...
We have enough on our plate.
But just as an idea of what could happen with these larger companies when they go public. So that kind of what I'm hearing from you as people are maybe thinking about IPOs, wanting to get in on an IPO, is that it can be very fruitful. It can be a good way to make money from investing, but you have to be ready for the potential for a big roller coaster, not just stock market in general roller coaster, which I know we're going to cover a little bit about here, you know, probably in the next segment, but generally speaking, in just an opening offer on one company, you've got, you know, your eggs in that one basket, and it could move, you know, you could get a year's worth of gains or losses in just a week.
Absolutely. Or a day. So I really like to recommend that if you're going to play in that realm, you keep it to a relatively slim slice of the pie. So maybe a couple of percent tops.
Sure.
Something like that.
That makes sense. You know, like, and when you say a couple percent, that's, we're talking about our overall
of the overall portfolio.
Right. Yeah. So just to give you an idea in dollars, if you have $100,000 saved for retirement, what Matt's saying is a general rule, and this is just a rule of thumb, general rule, we probably don't want to be more than a couple thousand invested into that one IPO, because exactly. It could really blow up your whole portfolio and hurt you for the long term.
And then there's always that caveat that it could turn out to be a huge winner. I have seen several clients in my experience that were able to own private shares of a company that went public about 8 or 9 years ago, right. And they were getting shares for cents,
right.
And those shares sold for $25, and they, you know, turned a $2,500 investment into a $160,000 payout. So, I mean,
right. I think as a local thing, I think Winco was a thing like that, right, where the ESOP that employees back, you know, 15 years ago or so were able to get this, you know, employee stock option program, and then they're able to cash out, you know, where you have cashiers that worked at Winco for several years that
walk away millionaires.
Now. Yeah, so that it can be very fruitful. I think the key there is tread with caution. Make sure you know the company that you're getting into.
Absolutely.
Right. Make sure you are working with a professional to ensure that your portfolio is not overweighted, and, you know, make sure we're getting into, you know, looking at your portfolio as a whole. If you have questions about that before we take a break here, make sure that you give us a call. We're happy to talk through it with you. Matt, myself, a member of our team, is happy to chat with you about how that may fit in your overall portfolio. And we're happy to do that. No obligation, no cost. Give us a call, 503-253-3000, or shoot us an email, askbo@pfgwm.com, or visit our website at pfgwm.com. This is Investing Simplified, and we'll be right back with the debut of a new segment called Get Real. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Are you concerned about your retirement income? Do you really understand how your Social Security benefits work? Price Financial Group Wealth Management has helped many seniors in Oregon and Washington maximize their Social Security benefits at retirement through using their Social Security Seminar on Demand. Now you can watch this valuable information in the comfort of your home by just going to www.pfgwm.com and click on the free Social Security Kit. If you are serious about your retirement planning, you cannot afford to miss this opportunity. After all, you have invested your hard-earned dollars into Social Security all your working years. So shouldn't you get the maximum return you can get from those dollars? The future can be scary, and without a plan, it can be even scarier, especially when facing the unknown. What you don't know can hurt you. Get your free Social Security Kit at pfgwm.com or call 503-253-3000.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
And welcome back to Investing Simplified. If you're just now tuning in, thank you for joining us. If you've been with us so far today, we appreciate you sticking with, and you're probably as excited as I am for the debut of our brand new segment, which we are calling
Get Real.
That's Matt May, Chief Investment Officer, Price Hey-o. Financial Group. Hey-o. And we're debuting your new segment today. It's called Get Real. And Matt, what do you got on the docket today?
Today, I'd like to continue the battle of active versus passive.
Sure.
Remember from our previous episodes,
yeah.
we were talking about active versus passive, and that's the different ways of investing in the market. Active being, we have those teams of professionals that are picking investments inside that particular asset class, or we just want to own the index, and the index is the typically cheaper way to go, and there's no active management. You just kind of buy it and hold it.
Yeah, yeah.
So this week, I picked out I don't want to say I cherry-picked it. I just would say that this is my favorite asset class, and this is an idea that has some juice to it.
Wait, let me just jump in here. Is it emerging markets?
You know me too well. It's like I have you had a 50% chance,
right?
Of getting it right. It's either emerging markets or
small caps. Yeah,
with the juice. So this one's emerging markets, and emerging markets are really a volatile index at times. It is positive on the year this year and outperforming the S&P 500, but it does carry an additional amount of risk. So normally when we're looking at risk, the S&P 500 on a scale of 1 to 99 carries a risk of about 75. And the index fund, which is the iShares Emerging Markets Index Fund, there are several, but that's the one I chose.
And does that track the, you know, that iShares tracks a certain, you know, international or emerging markets index? I've heard the emerging markets index is generally run by the MSCWI, or, you know.
Correct. It tracks that particular emerging market index.
Right. Which, yep. So for people that don't know, is a Morgan Stanley Capital Group, world index, right?
Correct. Yep.
And so that's all the emerging markets. Just before you get into it, I want to give people a little background of like emerging markets, meaning those are underdeveloped economies as opposed to the developed economies like the U.S. and European markets. Underdeveloped markets generally include, you know, those smaller countries that are around the globe, but have companies that are up and coming, but maybe not be as developed as the U.S., right?
Right. Some examples would be India, mm-hmm. Malaysia, and even China is considered emerging markets. And that one always kind of makes me take a pause, because China, the second largest economy in the world,
sure.
they're still emerging because only a smaller fraction of their population is middle class or urban.
Right.
It's everyone else is
right. agrarian still. And yeah,
right. Yeah. And they're, you know, of course, building mega cities.
Sure.
Years ago, that was the story, that these things are 80% unoccupied. But now those mega cities are something like 75% occupied. And now they're building, you know, dozens more.
Right. And there's companies coming out of there that, you know, that you can take advantage of. And, you know, but you're also talking about smaller countries, like you said, Malaysia, maybe Singapore, these countries that are building infrastructure, that have strong companies that are, you know, that are producing goods, that are making money, but they're maybe not just as strong of an economy overall as the U.S. or maybe Britain is, right?
Right. And there's the historical connotation that when you're talking emerging markets, that you're talking commodities, like
sure.
their economies are driven by commodities like oil,
gold,
precious metals, silver, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
But the story has really changed in those markets. So these are now, and something historically important happened in 2010. For the first time in the world's history, half the population became middle class. We crossed over into more people being middle class than lower class.
Less. Sure, yeah.
So that's really important, because what do middle class citizens have, or world
middle
class?
Right?
Yeah, they have
consume. Right,
they consume. They have enough money to live and cover their basic necessities, but they have a little bit extra for those, you know, the fringe benefits, iPhones, right? Internet.
Yeah.
Elon Musk is talking about, you know, he's already launching satellites for worldwide internet access, but you know, he wants to cover the emerging markets with high speed internet.
Sure,
so,
sure.
In that realm, there's of course two ways to go. My personal belief is that if I'm going into an emerging market or really anything outside of our shores, mm-hmm. I prefer to have active management.
Sure.
I prefer to have a team of professionals that is located in or near those geographic locations, so they have boots on the ground, so they can see the local markets, see the local economy, get a feel for things. So I tend to lean towards active management. There's nothing wrong with owning the index there either. I think if I had one investment to pick for a time capsule that was going to be opened in 10 years, I would certainly pick emerging markets as that asset class to go into the time capsule. So it's my favorite asset class for the long term, but you have to know that this thing can be volatile, and we sure. have to be careful of that. So into the battle, I picked iShares Emerging Markets Index, and that one on a scale of 1 to 99 has a risk level of 91. So it's juicy.
So we're talking about high risk. Well, that's when we're talking emerging markets. That's the other thing to make sure people understand. When you say it's our favorite, well, not our, it's your favorite investment class. It's not, doesn't mean that means everybody should be all in there. It means it's your favorite investment class to look at, but doesn't mean that it should be any more depending on your risk tolerance, any more than a small sleeve in your portfolio. If you have a very low risk tolerance, something that on a scale of 1 to 99 is 91 risk shouldn't be that much. You know, it should be a part of your portfolio, but not necessarily too big of a part.
And maybe not even a part at all, depending. If you're really conservative, obviously this is probably outside of your desired level of risk.
Sure.
So on the active side, I chose JP Morgan Emerging Markets Equity. That's a fund for any of the folks that have had me manage their money for a few years now. That's certainly a big part of their portfolio, or at least a component of many portfolios that I'm managing. So that's ticker symbol JEMSX. And on the iShares, the ticker is EEM, Echo, Echo, Mary. So on the active management fund side, that carries a risk level of 88.
Okay, so slightly less risk.
Slightly less risk.
Okay.
And it costs a little bit more. So the internal expenses on the JP Morgan fund are running about 0.99%, so just under 1%.
So almost 1%. But that iShares, I would imagine, is pretty low.
It's about 0.68%.
Okay, so that's higher than you generally see average. An index fund.
And you'd normally see that for index funds outside of the U.S.
Right.
So international funds generally carry higher expenses anyways. But that's one of the higher ones, and it has a pretty decent track record. So interesting note about the JP Morgan fund. If you're just walking in off the street and say, "Hey Matt, I want to buy JP Morgan Emerging Market Index Fund, but I don't want to, you know, get into an advisory account, a fee-based account."
Right.
You'd have to walk into an institution with $1 million.
Okay. So yeah, I'd have to have $1 million to buy and put all $1 million into that fund
into
if
that
I wanted
fund.
To get it without working with an advisor.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that means you become that's their institutional level to where you can buy in $1 million or okay. In an advisory account, typically it's well below 5,000.
Sure.
1,000 to 2,500 is typically the entry
minimum.
Amount. Yeah,
okay.
The minimum for a inside an advisory account. So I like that. Emerging markets, you could probably get one share for around less than $50.
Okay.
So that's your minimum there.
On the iShares.
On the iShares,
sure.
EEM.
Okay.
So the passive managed index fund.
Okay.
So let's get to the good stuff. The battle here, the active versus passive. If I'm going to own the passive, obviously there's generally no advisory fee. There's no right. There's a lower internal expense. So if I'm just a DIY investor, my total cost is whatever my commission was to buy the shares. Maybe usually like a Schwab or some other place, you don't have a cost to buy in an ETF, which this is.
Right.
So zero cost on the trading fee, and then maybe 0.68% or so annually as
sure.
an internal expense. On the JP Morgan side, generally either I have the $1 million or I pay an advisor a fee,
percentage, right? Yeah, an asset-based fee.
Something like that, yeah. So on a one-year, five-year, three-year basis, I like to look at all three of those time frames. I want to see a good active management outperformance. And really what I'm looking for is a fund that is in the top quartile, which is the top 25% of all funds in the space.
Sure.
On that 1 year, the 3 year, the 5 year. And on this one, the JP Morgan fund, on a 1 year basis, it returned about 23.7%.
Okay.
That beat the index by 12.86% net of expenses.
I think that's the big key there, right? So it outperformed the index, because that's always the question, right? If we're looking to whether we should have active management or passive management is, you know, why pay more? So what you just said was that investment, and again, this doesn't mean it's going to happen next year, tomorrow, whatever. This
absolutely.
This is what has happened over the time where you can see value coming from that investment. It outperformed. Okay, well, how about the three-year?
Three-year, we're up 9.64% per year. That's an average.
That's how much it beat it by.
Compounded, 9.64% per year. And it beat the index by 6.93% per year.
Wow, okay. So per year, you're winning every year for the last 3 years.
Beating it by almost 7% per year, sure. net of the internal fees.
Right.
And on the five-year, it's averaging 14.91% per year, beating the index by 5.74% per year. So those rankings on the 1 year gets it into the top 10% of all funds in the space. On a three-year, top 5% of all funds in the space. And on a five-year basis, it's the top 3% of all funds in the space. So you're Matt. Why can't I get the number one on the one-year, three-year, five-year? It's really, really tough for a fund to be top quartile, which is top 25%, on the one-year, three-year, and 5% timeframes.
Sure, that makes sense. And apologize to everyone. My computer just made a noise to notify us that, you know, something was happening. And so I think that's a good, you know, good point. And what I heard there, and the big keys that I want people to take away before we take a break, and we have Taylor Cattell joining us here in studio in just a second. I want to let you know that on a risk adjusted basis, right? That means that you are taking less risk in this particular fund over those periods that Matt talked about. You're taking less risk than the index and outperforming that index net of all fees.
One thing to consider, leaving you briefly, this data that I brought to you is as of September 15th of 2020.
Right. So just if you're looking out there, that data is as of September 15th or a little bit earlier this week. But we're not cherry picking. That's just giving you the full disclosure on there. So we're going to take a break. We're coming up against it a little bit, and we will be back with Taylor Cattell. And then after we speak to Taylor, we'll wrap up with you. Stay with us for Investing Simplified.
Legal matters are never easy, but they are especially difficult when they involve the most important people and aspects of your life. This is Taylor Cattell, founding partner of KG Law Group. It's important to have an attorney who cares about your unique circumstances and knows how to get the outcome that is best for you. At KG Law Group, we specialize in estate planning and family law, including wills, trusts, powers of attorney, guardianship, and divorce. At KG Law Group, we provide both expertise and compassion as we guide you through the complex legal landscape. We balance knowledge of the law with exemplary client service. Whether you're reacting to a crisis or planning for the future, we are here to help. If you need legal advice, give us a call today and schedule a consultation at 503-878-8948. That's 878-8948. Or visit us online at kglawgroup.com. That's kglawgroup.com, serving Oregon and Southwest Washington. KG Law Group, your family, your legacy.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
And welcome back to Investing Simplified. If you're just now joining us, welcome to Cover Your Assets with Taylor Cattell of KG Law Group in studio with us today. Matt, again, it's so great to have her back in here. Taylor, again, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule. I know that, you know, you guys have got a lot going on out here at the Bethany office. As a reminder, if you do want to meet with Taylor and her team, you can give her office a call. We'll give that number out here at the end of the segment. But she is available to meet with you here in our Bethany office or your St. John's office as well. If folks don't want to travel across town. And she is licensed in both Oregon and Washington, which is unusual to find in an estate attorney. So that's huge for those of us here in the Pacific Northwest. So Taylor, we had a question come in via the askbo@pfgwm.com. So if you have a question, send it there. We're happy to answer. But tell us a little bit about what this listener's question is.
Great. Thanks for that intro, Bo. It is really, and we are doing a lot of virtual appointments these days too, terribly convenient being here at the Bethany office with you.
Yeah.
So this question is from Kathy. And my normal disclaimer, I'm not giving legal advice to you, Kathy. I'm sorry, we'd have to do that, in a different context than the public radio. Mm-hmm. But you put a question out there, and I'm going to do my best to answer, generally speaking, about powers of attorney. The gist of the question, it's a little bit long, so I'm going to just summarize the highlights. Kathy said that she has an old power of attorney that appoints her spouse and then her children, and it takes effect immediately. Then she executed another power of attorney, and there are a couple questions she had about that, naming the spouse and then the three kids as co-agents after the spouse. But it's unclear whether it's immediately effective or whether she would have to be declared incapacitated in order for it to be effective. So that was one question. When does it become effective? Another was some additional instructions in this power of attorney where you could handwrite in certain apparently additional instructions. And then a few questions as far as how the declaration happens and whether you could just write in additional instructions for things that you would want, like making the power of attorney immediately effective and just initial it. So the short answer, when you have a power of attorney and then you decide I'm going to do a new one, usually the new power of attorney should revoke all prior powers of attorney. That's standard practice. If you do a do-it-yourself online, or if you have an attorney who doesn't know what they're doing, doesn't specialize in estate planning, it may or may not say that. There are powers of attorney that exist that you may feel so uncomfortable with, you want to specifically revoke. Powers of attorney in Oregon can basically be relied upon by, let's say, this is usually a bank that you're dealing with, right? A third party that you're trying to prove, yes, I have authority as an agent for somebody else. That's usually you're taking a document into a bank and saying, I can access their account. That's the simplest.
Or, you know, for us, when we have clients that have powers of attorney for, usually it's an aging parent, right? Or maybe, maybe a spouse, you know, and I know you've done that for several of our clients, have the spouse's financial power of attorney just because maybe one spouse travels internationally or different things. But the ability to access those accounts if they're not in your name, right?
Technically speaking, an individual retirement account, an IRA, a Roth IRA, you're not supposed to, as a financial advisor, talk to the spouse if there's no POA on file.
Right. Exactly.
So important. It's very important.
Yeah. Even if compliance wise, even if I know both husband and wife very well, and I have sat with them together, you can talk about their account with that person present. But technically, like you're saying, you can't speak to it. And people don't understand that because the IRA, I learned this, and a listener actually corrected me, and I learned it by the IRA stands for Individual Retirement Agreement. An account, which is interesting to know, right? Because it's an agreement with the IRS that's your individual retirement agreement, right? You have that individual specifically. So
you're exactly right. The ownership is one person. It's vested in one person. So unless you have access to that and you don't just get it by virtue of a spouse or what, then there's other types of assets that are very similar that people don't understand. Well, why can't I just access that? Well, it's still, you're not the owner of it. You're the spouse, but that doesn't automatically just give you some right. And there are certain circumstances where you want that. Say a divorce is pending. That's just fine and dandy for those folks. But most of the time, there's an incorrect assumption that, well, I'm the spouse, so I just get that information or I can just make those changes. So having a power of attorney at all times of your life is important. And then you're dealing with the different layers of the financial institution. So you're dealing with Matt and Bo is essentially the gatekeeper saying, okay, I think this is going to get through our compliance. But then you've got the back office of whoever you're trying to work with who can say, I'm sorry, this is from 1991. And it's a one-page document that doesn't say, yes, it says my agent can do everything for me, but it doesn't say manage securities.
Right.
It doesn't say buy and sell investments, right? And so if your back office, as nice as you want to be, your hands might be tied on whether you can turn over that because there's a lot more abuse of powers of attorney these days, and financial institutions are, we'll call it shy, risk adverse of relying on any document that isn't pretty bulletproof and airtight. I do get clients who say, why is my power of attorney 10 pages long?
Right.
Well, I agree with you. It should be one sentence. This person can do everything I could do if I was here to actually do it. And maybe 50 years ago, that would have worked. But in today's world, if it's not detailed and specific, then it's not going to be accepted and relied upon. Once it's accepted and relied upon, the only way that that it can be revoked is typically by actual knowledge of its revocation. So if you think your power of attorney is being abused and you revoke it, you need to take it to that financial, you need to take it back to Bo and say, Bo, I think somebody's abusing my account, or I trusted my kid and I don't anymore.
Right.
I'm revoking this power of attorney so that they have actual knowledge. Okay, we got to take it out of our system. We need to red flag this. This is, you know, potential abuse situation, or however it works within the financial institution. So if you have concerns about a power of attorney that may be used that has not been revoked, having a separate revocation is fine. That's less usual. It's more common that you have an outdated document. Nobody's ever used it. You're not worried about abuse. It probably names the same people. You just need new boilerplate. Yeah. So you update a new power of attorney, revoke the other ones. Don't stress too much about that. The chances are very unlikely that that's going to be a problem, especially if you still trust the people who are named. So now you have a new power of attorney. That's the one that I would focus on. What does your new power of attorney say, and are you comfortable with those terms? Powers of attorney are don't have to be anything specific as far as formatting. There's no execution of required formalities in execution, but what is going to be relied upon? What's going to work? And almost every power of attorney is notarized. That's mainly, and it started out because you can't record a document in the public records for land without it being notarized. So if you want to be able to sell property with a power of attorney, it needs to be notarized. But now it's just the standard bearer of, well, it's not notarized. How do I know it's you? So having a document notarized is really important. Once that document is notarized, I would not recommend changing it and initialing it and making alterations, because it just makes it more suspect that it's not going to be relied upon. So having three additional instruction lines, to me, would really make me pause and hesitate. And if you're considering changing the nature of your power of attorney in any way, talk to an attorney.
Because it may not be the people that you're naming in the power of attorney. What if you have that document on file somewhere and just some employee gets a hold of it and it's got blanks that they could just fill in?
Right.
That was the big red flag that came up for me, was just having
named George W. Smith, the 100% control, and George W. Smith just walks in the institution and walks away with all the assets. Stuff.
Yeah, well, from our perspective, from you mentioned the compliance before, I can speak, you know, categorically that so we custody our assets with TD Ameritrade, right, among other custodians, but they will not accept an initialed, you know, a POA that has, you know, you've crossed something out and initialed here,
right,
or crossed something. Those are things that I know a lot of times people think same with wills, right?
Right.
Where they say, hey, well, this needs to change in my will. Can I just cross that page out and initial it? And, you know, that to me, it throws up a red flag, but also just you're just putting yourself, you're not covering your assets.
Right. Right. Exactly right.
Ding, ding, ding.
You're definitely putting yourself at more risk. And I say this, I know I've said it on the show, but I feel like I just want to be a broken record about it. Power of attorney is the simple, most cost-effective document you can possibly have.
Yeah.
I mean, the cost of conservatorship is astronomical compared to the cost of a validly, properly done power of attorney. And there's no other document that can have the same power that a power of attorney does that can really save for the people that you trust in the right context with the right, you know, preparation of it and execution of it. If it's all done right, it is a huge cost saving and stress savings benefit to it. So
I can imagine
it's a big deal to have it. It's an easy document to understand. It's an easy document to take care of. It's not an expensive document, relatively speaking, to get done. Often you can do a power of attorney, like with your financial investments, you can do one just at, say, TD Ameritrade or whatnot. And that doesn't take an attorney. In some ways, for a lot of financial institutions now, they won't even take ours. Right. They have to have a separate one that's at the custodian. So
in their language
with their rubber stamp prepared by their attorneys. Right. Name the same people, make it consistent.
Right.
But often you'll have multiple powers of attorney, maybe one for each institution where you have assets. And that's just the world in which we live. And there's would I change it? Yes. But I would change many things probably before that. And at the end of the day, you just need to do your homework and get it done and have it done right. There are a couple other things that make me pause in this question that I want to just highlight, and I don't need to fully unpack, but I just want to say one is becoming effective upon your incapacity versus immediately effective. Big question. Big question. what when it becomes effective upon your incapacity, it's called the springing power of attorney. It springs into action at some later date. That can be a really good choice for folks who have a lot of years left, and this is really just a precautionary measure. For those who expect that at some point, even in the next couple of years, I'm probably going to want to have this person step into my shoes a little bit, start maybe be able to write checks, or I'm going in for surgery, or I have a diagnosis, or I anticipate something. If you shouldn't name anybody you don't trust anyway.
Right.
If you have any concerns about trusting them, do not name them, period. Name someone else or don't have one and have the cost, but the accountability that comes with court supervision if you need it. So taking that factor away, you trust somebody completely now versus later. If you're going to need it in the foreseeable future, even as a possibility, just make it immediately effective and keep it easy. If you are not comfortable with that, if you have any, if you just don't see how you would, it would be a real freak accident that something would come up, then it's more protective to have it be springing, to have it come in later. But doctors are finicky people. They're people too. And some of them are great and they're willing to, you know, walk over hot coals for their patients and do what needs to be done to make sure that they're taken care of. And others say, I'm 80-year-old myself and I'm just fine, thank you very much, and can project their own thoughts in because they're humans too.
Right.
And getting a letter out of them saying, yes, the power of attorney can now be used is like pulling teeth, and they have to be, the principal has to be pretty deeply
far gone
before they're going to get the help that they needed months, years before.
Well, and just speaking from experience recently, we've had clients that sadly, you know, they're, as they start to degenerate into, you know, with dementia and with, you know, or your early onset Alzheimer's, anything like that, it can be kind of hard to notice the difference and getting them into the doctor to get that diagnosis, particularly if they have now become sort of entrenched in, I'm fine. I can handle everything myself. I don't need, you know, because you really do change, and you notice that it oftentimes is a, not necessarily a different person, but to a certain extent, they are a different person, right?
Especially when it's gradual. It doesn't start you don't as notice 100% it. Of a condition. Maybe it starts a little bit every
forgetting
once in a
here,
while.
Yeah. And then suddenly it becomes that, hey, no, I never wanted to sign that. I don't want to do, you know, and you can't get mom to sign this, you know, thing, and she is missing checks, or she can't, you know, the minute you go over and you say, hey, you know, did any mail come today? Because the mail's all getting sent to her because you haven't been set up as power of attorney, and she goes and gets the mail and hides it somewhere and forgets about it because she's not hiding it on purpose. It's just, and no mail came, and you have to go search through. Okay, there's mail back here behind the shelf because mom doesn't, you know, because that sort of situation just degenerates quickly, right? So, I speaking purely from zero legal experience or zero legal expertise, I would always lean towards you find someone you trust and just have it set up.
Right.
Because if you get to the point, like you said, you know, mom's behind on rent checks or behind on this, and you get a doctor that for some reason, whatever reason, they are unwilling to say that this is, you know, to do the court. I don't even know what the requirements that they have to say, but whatever they have to put on paper and put their rubber stamp to, yep, she needs the springing power of attorney. To me, it would just make sense to have somebody you know is not going to abuse it, is not going to take advantage of it, and just they'll be able to step in without having to jump through those extra hoops to make sure you're taken care of, right?
The level of elderly abuse has just skyrocketed over the last decade. It's astonishing.
It really has. It really has. And it's amazing who people I have, because I'm on the front lines of, should I name this person? And it's very hard sometimes to decipher a hesitation. Is it because I'm not sure what this document is? Is it because I'm, you know, and that's fine and that's normal. But then there's the clients who I can just see there's more, and trying to unpack the hesitations they have about their kids, the sense of obligation to name a child. Let's say you've got an only child and they're not especially well functioning, but you feel obligated to name a child instead of a neighbor or a friend or a sibling, or there's a lot of emotional discussion
baggage,
or thoughts or context in which you're trying to make these very, from my perspective, very legal, financial, black and white yes or no. You have to be really far of this side of the line on trusting a person before you're going to put them in a power of attorney. But people feel swayed, or they feel, well, they'll be really upset if I don't. Well, those aren't reasons to name somebody. But those are all the discussions that you'd want to try to unpack. And if you're not comfortable unpacking with an attorney, or you're concerned about the bill, or I do my stuff on fixed fees so that we can talk about this and I don't have clients watching the clock. But if you're working with an attorney who's hourly and you're comfortable and you want to stay with that person, and that's, which is absolutely fine, but unpack it with the people that you're closest with, unpack it with people that you feel like you should name and talk through what do they think. Unpack it with your financial advisor, call Bo and Matt and say, this is what I'm thinking, but what do you think? And that's part of who your trusted advisors are, is to say, gosh, you know, I've known you for 10 years. I've seen this kid go through 3 different marriages in that time, and all of them have been really questionable spouses. As much as you love this person, maybe the influence they have, other people have over them, is not a good thing, right? So those are the things that the people who know you best are going to be able to reflect back to you. It's not a small decision. So definitely to take it. And the next piece of that, which dovetails perfectly into all of this discussion, is whether to name all of your kids as co-agents.
Yeah, that was a question I had, because, you know, sometimes when you have multiple people over there, Matt and I just actually were dealing with this very recently, where you have one child in Florida, one in New York, you know, one here and there, and you've got to get, you know, send paperwork off to all the different kids before anything can get done. And it can provide, you know, a real headache in that situation.
Everyone has to agree. And
yeah.
Right. Exactly. Now, there are ways, like in my documents, I allow different people who are named to work together, because if the goal is I want my kids to communicate with each other, or I want them to be, one person's better at property management, they do that professionally, and another person is better at, you know, writing the checks and keeping track of utilities because they're closer. Those are the kinds of things that we can work with within and structure it within your power of attorney. But naming them as co-agents is almost never what I would consider a solution, because of all of the hoops that you end up jumping through. And I think attorneys will do it without that conversation if they don't do the administration of it.
Sure.
Right. I think there's a number of attorneys who just say, power of attorney, I can do that. Right. That's not very hard. I have a form.
Yeah.
And they give you that form and they notarize it for you, and they don't know a whole lot more than you do as far as what it says or how, you know, what that, it's all boilerplate anyway, right? Well, that boilerplate becomes really important when you're fighting with a financial institution on what authority you have to release securities or change beneficiaries, if that's the right, you know, if that's the authority that you want in it to maybe make it fit with your estate plan and get the advantages now that the Secure Act, the law changed on you and you didn't know.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of circumstances where this can be just a critical piece. And I think it's really important to have, again, that depth of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, however many people you want to name, but not all together is my general recommendation.
It's just like a financial plan where we're trying to look as far down the road as possible to avoid the potholes, and the estate plan needs to have that same kind of vision.
Exactly. And how are you going to fulfill that financial plan if you have a longer period of incapacity, which it sounds so scary. I think it's the hardest thing for people to think about, because death is like, it's going to happen at some point. Hopefully not soon.
Nobody gets out alive.
Yeah, but nobody gets out alive. But incapacity, that's brutal, right? Nobody wants to live without their wits about them. And nobody wants to be in a place where you're dependent on others. And so I think it's the hardest thing to say, gosh, I need to plan for that, because you don't want to even think about that as a possibility. And I'm not saying it's going to happen. I am saying that more and more people are facing it.
Right.
But for such a simple tool, it's just wildly important to make sure that your bases are covered as part of your estate plan.
And from our side of the house, I have so many clients that have parents that are dealing with those types of very expensive issues.
Yeah.
And then we talk to the children about how to mitigate those potential costs in the future. Oh, that's not going to happen to me.
Right.
It's astonishing how difficult that conversation can be. It's like, well, do we want to solve a 75 or 85 year old problem when we're 75 or 85? Probably not.
Right.
Maybe at 45 or 55 is a better idea.
Right.
But it really is a tough conversation. It's it's one of those things. Life insurance and long-term care conversations are the most difficult conversations usually.
Right. Yeah. People don't want to have them. But if you do want to have that conversation, if you know, that's what we call in the business a segue. Right? No, but if you do want to have those conversations, if you have questions about your power of attorney, you want to have things like that reviewed, give Taylor's office a call. And Taylor, how do they get a hold of you?
You can give us a call at 503-878-8948 or find us online. You can get our contact information and shoot us a message or an email there at kglawgroup.com.
And if you have a question like Kathy, it was right that said that you have a question like Kathy, you have something else that's been keeping you up at night, please don't hesitate to send that to Ask Bo. That's askbo@pfgwm.com. Stay with us. We'll be back with more Investing Simplified.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
All right, welcome back to Investing Simplified. Thanks for sticking with us through the show today. We've had Taylor Cattell on the show, and it's always a pleasure. I know people have been asking when we're going to have Kevin Stege back on the show, and I'm hopeful that we'll have him on soon. He and I have just been trying to get our schedules organized that he can be on the show with Matt and I. But I wanted to let you know that coming up soon, in a couple of weeks, we're going to have Steve Anderson back on the show. He's the gentleman who helps folks with property taxes, and also he's got some great information on what you can do if you were affected by the wildfires and how that's working with Multnomah County, Clackamas County, and Marion County, if those were things that had affected you out there. So make sure if you have a question about your property taxes, about how to combat those, send those into askbo@pfgwm.com, and we'll make sure to include Steve on that. And again, just as a reminder, if you do have a question that's been keeping you up at night, and whether that's about investments, about taxes, about estate planning, please be sure to send those in to investingsimplifiedradio.com or to askbo@pfgwm.com. We'll do our best to get those covered on an upcoming show. You know, we've got some HSA questions. We've got, you know, we've got Brian Harrington, our PERS experts, coming in a couple weeks, Steve Anderson, the property tax expert, and hopefully Kevin Stege here on in the coming weeks. But we, you know, we have had Taylor and we have you, Matt, and I wanted to get back to I wanted to get back to what we were talking about a little bit a couple of segments ago. About the, you know, the big thing for me that I think we didn't, you know, hammer home is the not the right term on there, but it's the concept of risk adjusted return, right? Because so many people compare what their portfolio is doing to what they see on CNBC. And one of the big things that jumped out to me about what you were describing, and we are just using one, you know, particular asset class, emerging markets, and one particular index to track. But when you're using that benchmark to see how well you're doing, it's not just the pure returns. Although when you look at the, you were talking about what these have done, and the caveat always comes, past performance does not indicate future right. results, right? But just what we've seen, you know, over the years, that you can achieve what we call alpha, right, which is outperformance, and I'll let you speak to that in a second. But the big thing for me is we took less risk to get that alpha, right?
Absolutely. Slight less risk, more return. And one of the things that to keep in mind is when I'm building portfolios, this is, of course, just one slice, one little ingredient. But I use that approach for every single asset class. I'm out there looking for those top quartile funds on the 1 year, 3 year, 5 year. Emerging markets historically has been really, really tough to find those attributes. But some others are a little bit easier and some have better numbers like ones, ones, ones. Those are always beautiful to have. But if I, as long as everything's under the in the top 25%, I'm happy. Risk adjusted returns, though, we're taking a slight less risk here in this example, but usually it's, you know, risk number to risk number about the same, and we're just getting a good amount more return for the level of risk that we're taking.
Which is important, right? And I don't want people to think that we are saying that we are outperforming, that we are out there going to, you know, just drive home and beat them. We're not beating the market every year. We're not beating the market all the time. The goal is to, on a long-term basis, more often than not, outperform the market. And that's where we earn our keep, right? So we talk about the comprehensive financial planning that we provide for our clients. But a key piece of why you have an advisor is also helping you to invest your dollars. And if we're talking, and granted, this is one example, but if that's on a, you know, 6 or 7% a year, that you're getting a better performance than you are if you just went to Vanguard and invested in the index funds, I think that might be worth, you know, kicking the tires to see about working with an advisor.
Absolutely. And on that note, when you're thinking the average fee is around 1 to 1.25% on this particular fund that we were discussing earlier, you know, on a 1 year basis, 12.86%, you have to subtract out the advisor fee. So maybe take 1.25% off of that. We're still at like, you know, 11.25% or more outperformance on that.
Right.
For the same level of risk.
Right. And that's on one fund. And that, you know, we want to be, you know, the key is, you know, we want to be clear about there's a lot of other things that you get from working with an advisor. And whether that's with us or with the advisor that you currently work
with. That's my CIO hat.
That's the other things that you get. So if it's something you want to take a look at, if you'd like to sit down with Matt, have him analyze your portfolio, give you that free comprehensive review on the what you've been investing, what you could be investing in, and see how it would look if you wanted to work with us and have him manage your portfolio, give us a call, 503-253-3000, or shoot us an email at askbo@pfgwm.com. I hate to cut us off, Matt. It's always so fun to talk, but we will be back
goes fast.
with the listeners next week. Please send us your questions. Tune in next week. And please be careful out there as the smoke begins to clear, that there's just constant dangers out there. And we really do care about you. So thank you for listening. God bless you all. Have a great rest of your week.
You can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified at pfgwm.com. This show was brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, 97216, 503-253-3000, or 877-50-PRICE. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. We'll be right back.